Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. I am your host, one of your hosts today, Ben. I'm here with Matt.
I'm here.
And we're excited to bring you this interview. Matt, you conducted this interview by yourself with Ron Sider. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
Such a big boy. Doing interviews all by yourself. What is Matt?
If this is your first time listening to the podcast, you're like, gosh, that Ben guy is kind of a paternalistic jerk.
I know. I felt bad about it because I'm like, well, hopefully everybody knows I'm joking. I'm not normally like this. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So anyway. It's funny because Matt, you are, you know, more than capable of conducting an interview on your own. Of course you are. That's why it's a funny joke, everybody.
And if anybody's going to be condescending, paternalistic jerk, it's me. So this is a complete reversal.
It's a reversal of fortunes. Yeah.
So Ron Sider is this guy who writes stuff for the church about economics and violence and other things. And he has this crazy prophetic edge to him. Like he says things that other people won't say that you really can't argue with. I mean, people do argue with him. Don't get me wrong. But it's like he's the guy that you just can't argue with and you just wish wouldn't write books, but he does. And he says things that are so challenging. And so one of the things he's written three books on nonviolence. We had him on earlier to talk about how Jesus talked about nonviolence and the early church witnessed to nonviolence. This book today was about how nonviolence is actually changing the world. People in different countries and different situations who are legitimately employing nonviolent means to oppose and overthrow violent dictators and tyrannical governments. And it's not just pie in the sky. It's not just wishful thinking. It's not letting a million people die while you pray in your room without a gun in your hand. I mean, these are like fierce stories, usually, by the way, of women who are employing nonviolent means to thwart violence. And so Ron's written a book about this, and we talked to him about it. I commend it because the biggest argument I hear about being nonviolent is that it's simply not practical.
It won't work.
It's not practical. Jesus says, love your neighbor, and pray for those who persecute you and turn to their cheek. But really, when push comes to shove, you better shove. And Ron just says, well, you know what? How about develop this imagination? How about allow this imagination to be funded here? I'm just struck by how, like, Ron has written a book of stories. Some of them are Christians, some of them aren't, who are making nonviolence practical.
Love that. Yeah, I hear the same thing. I think it's difficult to imagine, and therefore we just assume that it's too risky to try.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. Can I tell you a secret? Can I tell you a secret, Ben?
Sure. Lean in, though.
All right.
Don't let anybody else hear.
Yeah. I think that one of the major obstacles to nonviolence is that for Christians is we believe death is the worst thing that could happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we take our death off the table as a non-negotiable, and then we look for ways to resolve conflict and violence.
Yeah.
And Christians, including Jesus, that's not how they didn't see death as the worst thing that could happen. In fact, early Christians saw martyrdom or death as the best thing that could happen to them.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't surprise me that they had a robust imagination for what nonviolence could do.
Yes. Yeah, their vision of flourishing was just so very different from how we think about it in the Western world, the affluent Western world. We imagine that suffering and death are some of the worst things that could ever happen to us. And we just can't imagine our way into the good life that would include those things.
Yeah. So, anyway. So Ron's going to talk us about that. We're going to put his book in the show notes, and I just encourage you to let your imagination be funded by a love that doesn't seek to preserve self.
Mm.
I need that too. I need that.
Yes.
Too.
Yeah, we all do. All right. Enjoy the interview.
Friends. Get ready.
Get ready.
Ron Sider, welcome back to the podcast. Good to see you.
Delighted to be with you again.
Yes. Ron, would you give our listeners a brief introduction to who you are for those who are unfamiliar with you?
I'm a farm boy from Southern Ontario who was the first person in my family to go to college. I was fortunate to get a good scholarship and do a PhD at Yale in history. And then I taught at Messiah College in the inner city campus became deeply engaged in questions of racial justice and economic justice. My best known book is Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger.
Yes.
Which has dealt with the issue of global hunger. I've tried throughout my life to put Jesus at the center and let the full scriptures be my norm, and I've been called to try to combine word and deed, evangelism and social action. Got a book called Good News and Good Works that talks about how those two fit together. I'm now 80 years old and retired. And I like to say, if you're 80 years old and you love the Lord and you love your wife and you love the work you're still doing and the doctor says you're in good health, does it get better than that?
Yeah. That's great, man. I mean, there is this ageism that's settled into our culture where older people are maybe discarded or not as respected as we're a youth culture. But I got to tell you, it's so good to hear you say that. We need 80-year-olds who are excited about being 80 and aren't afraid to talk about it. Like we need fathers and mothers like that. So welcome back to the podcast. We had you on last time to talk a little bit about what was a more like theological, biblical book, If Jesus is Lord, Loving Our Enemies in an Age of Violence, where you kind of go through the texts of scripture and make a case for loving enemies through nonviolence as being biblically faithful. It's one of three books you've written on this. And we thought it might be pertinent to have you back and talk about an earlier book that you wrote that was more based on stories called Nonviolent Action, What Christian Ethics Demands, But Most Christians Have Never Really Tried. Ron, maybe to start off, why did you decide to write a book basically of case studies of how nonviolent action has worked?
Yeah, well, I really wanted to do two prior books before I got to the one that we were on talking about the last time. Because I have felt all my life that Jesus really meant to say where his disciples are not supposed to kill. But in order to get to that book, I wanted to know, first of all, what the early church said about killing. And that was my first book, The Early Church on Killing, where I collected everything that we now is extant, which we now have on the early church and killing up until Constantine. And the short summary is that there's not one single author up until the time of Constantine, who talks about killing and says it's okay for Christians to kill. They always say when they talk about it, no. But
yes.
Then the book that you referenced, Nonviolent Action, I think the strongest argument against my position and the most standard argument is that people who are, quote, pacifists committed to nonviolence are really not accepting their responsibility to work for justice and peace. C.S. Lewis famously said that he didn't think that if Jesus was standing there and somebody came along and tried to push him aside so he could go and kill his neighbor, that Jesus would just say, okay, I won't do anything. I think C.S. Lewis is right. If there are only two options, and Gandhi put it famously, if only two options are to do nothing in the face of terrible evil or to kill, of course we should kill. But the Nonviolent Action book points out that there's always a third option.
Yes.
We can always intervene nonviolently. The amazing truth is that in the last 50 years, especially 60, 75, the success of nonviolence has been demonstrated again and again. We all know about Gandhi, who changed British history in India with famous nonviolent campaign. Dr. Martin Luther King changed American history in important ways. Not enough, but in wonderfully important ways through his nonviolence. And it's not just that. In the Philippines, there was a vicious dictator, Marcos. He ruled for a long time, and people thought it, the only way to get rid of him would be a 10-year civil war. But in fact, a nonviolent campaign, a million-plus people came out into the streets, and the military that he sent to repress them just refused to shoot at praying nuns standing in, or kneeling in front of tanks, and he was overthrown.
Yes.
Or in Poland, there was a vicious communist dictatorship there, and Solidarity used nonviolence. And in fact, defeated the communist dictatorship. The story goes on and on. Women in Liberia did an amazing nonviolent campaign against a brutal dictator there, President Taylor. And again, they won. So nonviolence works. In fact, there was a book, scholarly book by Columbia University Press a few years ago. And two scholars had studied about 300 of the most important, both violent and nonviolent campaigns in the last 100 years. And they discovered that the nonviolent campaigns were about twice as likely to succeed as the violent campaigns. And they were far more likely to produce a democratic future after the revolution. So nonviolence works. It's not true that there are just two options. Nothing, do nothing, or kill. There's always a third option of nonviolent action, and it often works.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you, so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission, and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
Yes. Well, Ron, I want to dig in maybe a little more into these particulars, but I know that you yourself participated in some nonviolent action. Was it 80s or 90s? You talk about it.
Mid-80s. I was involved, I think, on the advisory board of Witness for Peace. In the early 80s, the Sandinista government had taken over in Nicaragua in 1979, and the Sandinistas were a mix of some hardcore Marxists, some more nationalists, but they were certainly sympathetic to Soviet Union. And President Reagan decided to fund the Contras, that was a military group that was trying to overthrow the Sandinistas. And in fact, many, many people were being killed. It was just devastating Nicaragua. And what Witness for Peace said was, we're going to go down as American Christians, and we're going to stand between the Contras and the Nicaraguan people. They weren't taking a stand for or against the politics of the Sandinistas, but they said it's wrong for the American government to be funding Contras who were killing hundreds and hundreds of Nicaraguans, doctors, teachers, and so on. And I actually went down in early 1985. Actually, I had given a speech at the Mennonite World Conference in July of the year before on the Anabaptist tradition of nonviolence, and that has led to Christian peacemaker teams, which now intervene in situations of conflict around the world. But I hadn't actually done it myself, and in that, I think it was January of 85, I went down. It was not exactly the safest kind of thing to do. When we got there, we were told that we were supposed to go into a city called San Juan de la Maya, I think it was. That city was under a terrible attack by the Contras, funded by the U.S. They had killed people in the previous month, and they asked us, are we ready to go in? So we decided, yes, that's why we came, we'll do it. And as we wound down the mountain down to the city, we knew there were probably 1,000 Contras watching us in their binoculars. We didn't know if we would be safe. But when we got there, the people in the city said that night, for the first time, they slept peacefully because they were pretty sure that the Contras would not attack Americans. U.S. money was funding the Contras. It wouldn't have been good politics for them to kill praying Americans who were in that town. So it was important to do that, to put in practice what I had urged others to do in my speech at the Mennonite World Conference.
Yeah.
That was an important time for me.
Yeah, so you were around 50 years old. Yeah? Ish?
Let's see. 79. I was 45, 46. Yeah.
Okay, so you probably have family, kids, you know.
Yeah. Two boys and a daughter.
Yeah. And so I'm just reminded of like 1 John 4 as you're talking, Ron. You know, he talks about what love is, John does. And he says in verse 10, this is love. It is not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his son as a sacrifice that deals with our sins. Another way to say that, maybe the Ron Sider translation would say, sent his son to be the nonviolent action that saved us from down his life. This is how we know what love is. In a real sense, you were enacting the love of Christ on behalf of these people, meaning you knew that the optics would be bad for the people being funded by America to kill Americans. So you used your body as a definitive no against violence and hoped that the optics would be stronger than their desired to kill you. Yeah?
Something like that. I certainly wouldn't want to put it anywhere close to what Christ was doing in the incarnation and the cross. But I do think the New Testament calls us to follow Christ and live like him. And so in very, very tiny ways, I suppose there's some analogy.
You coming down the mountain wasn't atoning for this village, I just want to be clear. But in a real sense, Ron, I think that what I mostly hear from people, and you referenced this earlier, is that there's two options. We either check out and go passive, or we kill. And I think most people, they just lack an imagination for how to leverage their power for the sake of love in an engaged, active, you know, rigorous way, in a way that costs them. And so this book of stories, sharing these stories about how people have done this, I think just expands and blows up our imagination so that we can imagine what it looks like to respond nonviolently in love towards evil and suffering in our world.
Yeah, the stories are simply amazing and wonderful. Just ordinary people, you know, in the Philippines, there was some preparation, but not massive preparation. And Marcos tried to steal the election.
And yes.
Just a million plus people came out into the central thoroughfare and protested. And Marcos sent his troops, and you know, they came in, they moved toward the people. There's an amazing story where praying nuns are right under the treads of a huge tank.
Yes.
And the tank edges forward just you know, a few inches and then stops, and edges forward a couple inches and stops. And in one case, the soldiers were just clearly, you could visibly see them, they said, wrestling with what to do. And finally, they just couldn't pull the trigger on all these fellow citizens sitting there, kneeling there, praying, and ready to give their lives. And that was what finally ended the dictatorship of Marcos.
Yep. The thing that's common through all these stories is how most of these nonviolent, I think every one of these nonviolent sort of action revolutions was grassroots from the ground up. It wasn't orchestrated by a government, or it wasn't funded by a budget. Some of them were like you said, like in the moment responses. I'm struck by how many are led by women too in this book. But I just think that's, I want to hold that before us, that I think if we added up the military spending of every government in the world per year, we're talking what, trillions of dollars, trillion dollars, at least billions of dollars.
A trillion plus. The U.S. budget is somewhere around $700 billion just by itself, and we spend more than the next four or five countries combined. But it's way over $1 trillion every year. Yeah.
So it's staggering to me that even when the world spends $1 trillion a year on violent resolutions to conflict, nonviolent action that gets no funds, practically no funds, is still more effective. Like, what would happen if we took 1% of the $1 trillion and funded and trained people into nonviolent resistance and action? It just blows my mind. Like, so your book doesn't just say nonviolent action is faithful. Your book doesn't just say nonviolent action can work sometimes. Your book is saying nonviolent action is changing the world, and it's more effective than killing, and it's not getting any of the resources that violence is getting.
Well, there's a World Peace Tax Fund that gets introduced every year in the U.S. Congress, and a few, not a majority, of people in the House co-sponsor it. And it would simply give American taxpayers the freedom to designate some of their taxes, the amount that goes to the military, to world peacemaking. That's worth supporting. The other thing that I think is really important, it's central to the argument of my book, Nonviolent Action, is that I think that the ethical logic of both just war Christians and nonviolent or pacifist Christians requires that they do the kind of nonviolent intervention that I'm talking about. You know, just war people say that you can't go to war unless
you exhaust every possible means.
And one of the criteria, you know, it must be a just war, must be declared, must not aim at civilians. But one of the criteria is precisely that you have to have explored carefully and openly all the viable nonviolent alternatives. And I say to just war people, given the amazing success of nonviolent campaigns in the last 50, 75 years, how can you claim that you're meeting your own criteria of a last resort unless we decide that as Christians, we're going to invest millions and millions of dollars and train thousands and thousands of our people in the techniques of nonviolence and then move into situations. And as far as pacifists are concerned, I say, you know, we claim to have an alternative to war and killing. But that rings hollow unless we're willing to engage in the kind of dangerous intervention that soldiers are willing to do, risking their lives. They hope for peace and justice, And we don't have any integrity as pacifists unless we do the same sort of thing. So the logic, the ethical logic of both of the major Christian traditions on war and killing compel, require that they get involved in this kind of nonviolent action.
Yes. Yes. So we've been talking global, worldwide, political nationalities. Let's bring it down to like the local church pastor for just a moment. Over the last maybe, 5-10 years, the proliferation of stories about active shooters in churches has just skyrocketed. People are coming into churches, shooting up churches. And so churches are developing these policies now of having pistols in the pulpit and armed guards standing at the door during worship. And so I wonder, Ron, taking your knowledge, your exegesis, your theology, what would you propose as an alternative to like a violent protection of a violent intruder for churches? What could churches begin to explore on ways to make their spaces safe that doesn't actually lead to more violence?
Yeah, well, that's not an easy question, and that's tough. But I go to a church that believes that Christians are not supposed to kill. We don't have people there with guns, and we don't prepare for that. What I think would be appropriate, I'm not sure that my local congregation does this, but to the extent that a congregation feels that they need to prepare for the possibility of a violent intruder, then I think they ought to be talking about the techniques of nonviolence. They ought to be talking about how they would respond, how people would rush that person. I don't think that Jesus' nonviolence means that we do nothing in the face of evil. I think it would be entirely appropriate for a number of people to rush the person. Initially, a few, of course, would get shot and killed, but they would quickly overwhelm that person and physically restrain him and take the gun away. I think that kind of discussion and that kind of preparation would be entirely appropriate.
Yes. It struck me again, something you said in our first podcast that's worth repeating. I think as I think through that, what occurs to me is that for many Christians, the worst possible thing that could happen to them is that they would die. And so they have to keep themselves alive at any cost. But I think what the New Testament reveals, I think you would contend for this too, Ron, you may have even said this last time, is that the worst possible thing for a Christian isn't that you would die, it's that you would murder somebody.
That he could abandon Jesus and fail to live like Jesus. And
yes.
If one believes, as Christians do, that death is not the end, that Jesus rose from the dead and promises that we too will live forever with him, then I'm very much at 80. I want to live some more and enjoy my grandchildren. But death is not the worst thing that can happen. The worst thing that can happen is to abandon Jesus.
Yeah, and there's a lot of ways to abandon Jesus. Yeah. Well, Ron, if just maybe as we wrap up here, what are some, you mentioned a few organizations, different peacemaking groups that you've been a part of, or that you, where would I go if I wanted to get more resources or information about training in nonviolence and people who are actively resourcing people on how to develop those competencies and imaginations? Where would I go for that?
Yeah. Well, one place is certainly Christian Peacemaker Teams. They have a website and people volunteer. They have people, for example, in the West Bank, in Hebron, in the West Bank. They've been active in Colombia. I think that today they are active in Iraq, in the Kurdish section of Iraq. So, they're doing it. They're training their people. They've got materials. There's a whole book or two on the history of Christian Peacemaker Teams on their website. They even have my 1984 Strasbourg speech where I talked about the idea and initiated that whole process in the Mennonite world. one could just Google nonviolent direct action, lots of things would come up. You know, in my book, Nonviolent Action, I have a bibliography, so there are lots of sources there where people can go.
Yeah, great. Well, Ron, I think it just bears repeating, even those of our listeners, we have a lot of listeners who maybe aren't committed to Christian nonviolence or pacifism. Maybe they fancy themselves or have convictions about just war theory. And I think you would argue that even if you're a just war theorist as a Christian, you should be trained in nonviolent action because part of your logic is to exhaust those possibilities.
Yeah, we should explore for the first time ever in Christian history, if you will,
how
much we could do through nonviolent resistance to evil. Until we really try that in large numbers, we'll never know. But it seems to me that just war ethics and pacifist ethics require that we do that.
Yeah. Well, Ron, thank you so much for your witness, faithful witness, decades and decades of calling the church to faithfulness in uncomfortable ways, right? So your books are written on topics that you don't bring up at holidays with extended family members. They make us uncomfortable. They're really challenging. They call us into a deeper faithfulness maybe than most Americans want to think we need to do. But I just so appreciate you, your writings. Are you working on anything now? Do you have any other writing projects on the horizon?
I'm actually working on two collections of my speeches and sermons that will come out in the next 12 months. Excuse me. I'm working on an autobiography that hasn't even started to be written, but I'll do that in the next 12 months, I would guess. And I do a regular blog, ronsiderblog.substack.com. It's free, and I'd be delighted to have people join.
Yeah. Well, great. We'll put that link in our show notes. Ron, thanks for being with us this morning. Enjoy the rest of your well-earned retirement.
Thank you.
God bless.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebbe, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.